by Dr. Meghna Sabharwal from the University of Texas at Dallas in the United States of America. So let us give a big round of applause to Dr. Meghna. Now I request one of my students, Afreen, to offer a bouquet of flower to Dr. Meghna Sabharwal. Let me just give a brief introduction about Dr. Meghna Sabharwal. Meghna is basically from India. She looks Indian. She loves India. She has just been to many cities of India, Chennai, Hyderabad, Pune, Delhi. She has roots in Agra, Haridwar. Next week she'll be traveling to Kolkata. So she's basically a very pan-Indian person. Meghna did her undergraduate degree, bachelor's from N.G. Ranga University in Hyderabad. Then she went to US. She did her master's from Arizona State University. Then she did her PhD from also Arizona State University in Phoenix, Arizona, US. Then she was a postdoctoral fellow at City University of New York from 2008 to 2009. And since 2009, she's been in the faculty of School of Economics, Political and Policy Sciences in University of Texas at Dallas in US. So Dr. Meghna has written extensively on many aspects of public administration. She has also written two edited books. One of them happens to be Public Administration in South Asia, which is the title of today's lecture. Incidentally, this book was conceived about 2-3 years ago, I believe, Meghna. And we are extremely privileged, myself and Roomki, to be in this particular enterprise. And she has got a copy of this particular book.
And I'd like to present Professor Alan Gerard. And two of the authors are in this room, Professor Roomki Basu. She has a chapter on freedom of information.
He has a chapter on e-government in India. So thank you both. Basically, I must confess, I'm not a pop ed person per se, so I'm kind of intruder. Okay, I'm a political science kind of IR, so I'm eating into Roomki Basu's territory, so I'm feeling a bit intimidated. But anyway, this is a good book. This is there are 6 or 7 contributors from India. There are a couple of contributors from Pakistan, some of them from Bangladesh, I believe 1 or 2 from Sri Lanka. So this is very much a South Asian public ad. You will never come across a lot of books on public ad in South Asia. So this gives, I think, a very good overview about the issues that we deal with in different countries, in different ways, in different nuances, different contexts. Whether it is e-government, whether it is administrative reform, civil service issues, the issues of corruption, abject poverty, I mean, you pick the governance issues, the good governance, bad governance, I think Meghna is going to talk about it. So I think I don't like to talk too much on this particular occasion. So again, welcome to you, Meghna, to Incredible India, to Dilbalon Ki Dilli, to the most happening university in Delhi and NCR, and to the Department of Political Science, the department which is on the big leap forward, okay? Again, welcome to you here.
Thank you.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you very, very much for inviting me, Professor Alam and Professor Basu, to Jamia. I was here in 2011, but I didn't have the good fortune of visiting Jamia, so I appreciate you inviting me. Good morning to everyone here. I'm very, very happy to be back here in India. Of course, I was born here in Hyderabad. And I went to school and college in Hyderabad. My whole background is very varied in that sense. My bachelor's is in science, agricultural science. Just like parents in India, they tell you whether you have science option or engineering. So I didn't want to take math, so I said, oh fine, I'll do biology. Right? And so I ended up with agricultural science. I had one course on economics. And I started liking management and economics very much. So I said, what do I do with this? So I looked into programs for my master's in the US, and I had a program, agribusiness management. That's where I enrolled, and I got very interested in management. And that's how I went on to do a PhD in public administration with a focus on public management. So my areas of research are broadly human resource management, or what it's called as personnel management, which used to be called personnel. Now it's human resources management, a very important area. And then this project, I'll tell you how this came about. In 2009, I started as an assistant professor at University of Texas at Dallas, and I went to the big conference. How many of you know of ASPA? Anyone heard of ASPA? American Society for Public Administration. If you have not been a part of ASPA, if you haven't been to their website, I would encourage you to please go to ASPA's website. Their flagship journal is called PAR, Public Administration Review, and I'm sure you all use it for your own papers. Yes, everybody's nodding. I'm very happy. So please go look at ASPA. So we went to ASPA's conference in San Jose in 2010. And I was an assistant professor, quite naive. I was at a workshop and, you know, a panel where this professor, Professor Evan Berman, who's my co-editor, he was on the panel, and I wanted to meet him because I was using his HR book for my own classes. So right after the panel ended, I went up to him and I said, Professor Berman, I'm using your book. Students love your book. We are having great reviews. He said, oh, did you see my two recent books on public administration in East Asia and public administration in Southeast Asia? I said, yes, I just saw your books, and that's quite an amazing accomplishment. So then naively again, I asked him, so why not a book on public administration in South Asia? And he thought for a second. He looked at me, someone who doesn't know me. Why you want to do one, he asked me. I said, I want to do a book on public administration in South Asia. I said, yes, I would love to, but I've been far removed. My bachelor's is not in political science, and I've been far removed from the Indian context. How do I do a book on public administration in South Asia? But I think I took it up as a challenge. Here's this big professor in the field, Evan Berman, asking me, can you do it? I, of course, didn't want to say no. So I was at the right moment, at the right time kind of a situation, but I think we worked hard together. And that's when I started looking for people. We identified scholars like Professor Basu. She was probably among the first ones we identified in India, and through her, she was extremely well connected, as you all know, in the field of public administration in India. Our aim to begin was to have India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and Nepal. Of course, Nepal didn't work out. There were a few people who wanted money for the scholarship, and I told them that this is purely an academic pursuit. We don't get any money for such kinds of things. So you have to be passionate, right, about whatever you do and your research. So Nepal, for some reason, dropped out. Even Sri Lanka, we ended up with one chapter. But overall, we have 8 chapters from India, 8 chapters in Bangladesh, about 6 chapters in Pakistan, and then we have one in Sri Lanka. So we have close to 30 authors in this whole book. So you can imagine the magnanimity of the project, coordinating with 4 different countries, with 30 different authors. We thought this book will be released in 2012, but I must apologize, it took us a year longer. So the whole book, from start to finish, from the time of its inception, took us about 3 years. So it's been quite an involving project for Evan and me and all the authors. And I must say, a big round of applause to all the Indian authors. They've been excellent. They've stayed up to with their schedules. They've done an excellent job in writing. My editing job was much easier. So I thank you all. The book itself, you know, why public administration in South Asia? Firstly, there is no book of this nature. I will tell you that Pakistan has, in fact, recommended this book to be used as their textbook in public administration. So hopefully that will be using, they'll be using this as a textbook in Pakistan. And I think there are talks in Bangladesh too. So I'm hoping we do some more promotion of this in India as well, because it's important. We have different areas that I'll talk about, starting from bureaucracies, civil service, freedom of information, ethics, which is a very important topic, policy, the history of public administration in India. So I mean, just you name it and it's there. And the best part is, now this is the third book in its series, so you have similar chapters in East Asia and Southeast Asia. So you can do a comparative. If there are any PhD students here, if you're interested in, say, freedom of information, if you're interested in how ethics or the policies work, you can do a comparative across the board for these 15 different countries that already you have information on. So use this as a source of wealth for that purposes too. This is for, you know, master's, PhD students who do their thesis. Of course, South Asian countries, many more, but we focus on these three and one Sri Lanka, so almost four. Sri Lanka also is very well written. He's given us an overview of the entire public administration in that region. So I won't belabor about what's in the book. I'll leave it up for you all to read it. Hopefully, maybe library gets a copy down the road that you can borrow and look at. But why public administration in South Asia? Why is South Asia so important, right? One in five people in the world live in this region. That's a big number. So there's a lot of interest in this issue. Most of you read stuff that's very US or European centric. Correct? The models that you've been reading very much in, you know, US based, I think there needs to be an understanding of our own models, what work here. Because what we study always in the US doesn't necessarily work or is transferable in contexts like, you know, India, Bangladesh, Pakistan. And that was our key interest, is why we wanted to look at public administration in South Asia. Of course, India has been at the rising helm of, you know, just progress, growth. 1990, you all know liberalization happened. But I would really say last decade has been very, very important in terms of growth. So our GDPs have been rising, 8%. But then the question becomes, what is the GDP per capita? So let me give you a few numbers here. Our GDP, we are ranked 8th in the world. China is second, US is the first. But the GDP per capita, there's a vast gap. India's GDP per capita, as you know, is $1,500 US. And US, it's 48,000, of course, can't compare. But China, it's 5,400. So we are five times, in that sense, behind. Whereas, you know, population-wise, we're second. China surpasses us, you all know. Literacy rates too, we are far behind, about 60%. Versus, you know, China, it's about 90%. But one good thing going for India is the age. One biggest problem that's happening in China is it's an aging population. Their demands for healthcare will be just tremendous over the next few years. Their one-child policy is hurting them in that sense. India is a very young country. And I think that needs to be tapped into, that potential. And of course, public administration has a key role to play in that. So size of bureaucracy, a lot of people complain we have too big a bureaucracy. Correct? But if you look at numbers, we are not as big. So let me give you one statistic. The size of bureaucracy in India is about 1,600 per 100,000 or 1 lakh residents. So it's 1,000 bureaucrats per 1 lakh residents. Whereas in China, it's 2,400 bureaucrats per 1 lakh residents. And in the US, which complains too much about the size of bureaucracy, it's 7,700 per 1 lakh. Seven times, and they yet complain about the size of bureaucracies, make the government small. You all know about the federal shutdown that's been happening in the US. Very, very bad situation there. So we have some things going for us, but I think we have to look into several things. Firstly, we cannot keep patting our own backs. Yes, we've ridden on a service industry high for several years now. All the call centers, the MNCs, we've attracted, there have been jobs, wonderful. But how long do we ride on the service industry high? We need to think about it, because Philippines and other countries are taking over. All those call centers are soon going to move there. We need to invest in R&D. India only invests 1% of its GDP in R&D. South Korea is doing 4.5%. That's a huge number. So we need to start looking into innovation as well. And these are some of the driving forces. These are just thoughts I'm leaving out there for you to think about. But public administration in general, if you know about PA, you all read about it, we have a very strong historical legacy dating back all the way to the ancient times, correct? You know, the Mauryans, Ashokas, ethics. We've been talking about ethics since 300 BC. We still haven't figured it out, have we? This whole Mani Smriti, the text had Dharma Shastras, they have a very nice saying. It says that you can track the path of the flying bird, but it's hard to track the devious ways of the bureaucrats. This was said back in 1313 BC. And so we are still grappling with those same issues. And I think it's time to move on from there. We really need some serious reforms. We need serious leadership. We are in a leadership deficit. Yes, GDP is growing, but I don't think that's enough. I don't think those numbers are enough. We need to look at other measures as well. So we have a very strong legacy that you know historically, and we often blame it on the British. Yeah, the strong bureaucracies, the red tape, the hierarchies, everything that we have is in some ways coming from there. Not just the British, it's been coming from, you know, the Mughals, from the Mauryans. It's been carrying on from all that time. But do we just say that, well, it's not my fault, it is someone else's? Do we keep passing the blame? That's something that we need to, we need to think about. So the Indian Civil Service, a very strong system. You know, public administration focuses on bureaucracies, different from political science, which focuses on political institutions, you know, how voting happens and all of that. But public administration, really the key focus is bureaucracy. So I will talk a lot about bureaucracies here and the civil service system. So the Indian civil service system, of course, originated from the British. It was called the Steel Frame of India, right? So Professor Tumala, who has a chapter on Indian civil service, he's also a professor in the US, very senior, almost just retired now. So he said that there was nothing Indian about the civil service system, much less of civil, and it was of no service to India. And I think we, in some ways, we feel the same about our bureaucrats even to this date. So the bureaucracy in India has been very powerful. If you think about it, it originated even before democracy came in. Right? So the bureaucracy preceded democracy, and I think that's where the problem lies. Because they are so strong that they sometimes have a stronger hold over our political institutions. Over policy making, they have a very, very strong appeal in that. So our bureaucracies are very, very powerful. Of course, it's not a bad thing to have powerful bureaucracies if they work, right? In Pakistan, you read the chapter, they say that in fact the bureaucracy is the only thing that's been stable over the years, and that has worked for them. So yes, stability is important, you need that, but then it causes rigidity too. And we've been experiencing that over the years. We've been complaining about that. So my take on this is, the train has left the station, but the destination is far from where it is. We've started making changes. We've been in an India which is just growing. You know, me myself, I've seen so many changes. I remember growing up in Hyderabad, which is still considered a little more forward, but I used to stand every summer in long lines trying to buy a ticket to come to Delhi, AP Express. That was our ritual every summer. And if we didn't get there early, you know, you could be just standing there for the whole day. Paying bills, electricity, right? Water bills. We were standing in lines all day. That's changed now. That's really changed. And that goes a lot with, you know, what Professor Basu, Professor Alam have written in their books about the e-government. Excellent. It has helped. But we are still facing the challenges. 2011, I was here to do a project on central government ministries, on governance in India. And the same project survey was done in about 12 different countries. So I send in my request to these ministries that I want to do this survey in India, wanted about 200 complete surveys from IAS officers, IAS cadre. So again, I think I was naive. Professor Berman was heading the project. He said, I'm doing it in 12 different countries. I immediately asked, why not India? He said, you want to do it in India? I said, yeah, sure. 200 full surveys will not be a problem at all. I didn't know what I was getting into, right? So I was here, I went to ministry, I called them every day, and they said, fax karo, madam. So I faxed my request. Sorry, madam, fax nahi mila. Sometimes I have to fax a request 8 times. Right? Finally, this guy suggested, madam, aap email kar dijiye. I said, that's perfect. You know, better than faxing. I can just email it to them. So I emailed my request, and then I call back, follow up. And this guy says, I said, aapko mila email? He says, wo email check karne wala aaj absent hai. So we have a person in the ministries to check your email. So if he's absent, then the whole ministry will shut down, ho jayegi, correct? So I mean, in the sense, we are talking about e-governance. We are talking about everything that's going on. But yet at the basic level, Here are IAS officers, maybe they just don't want to check because again it's too much work for them. So that could be a factor. But I think that needs to be again a leadership. We are in a real leadership deficit, which, you know, I teach leadership and I strongly believe in that. So those are things India has to look into. We have to, if efficiencies, accountability, we need to work on those things. Another issue that I think we need to work on is bureaucratic performance. Well, when you have such strong bureaucracies, you would expect them to perform, correct? Right? So why is there a lag? Why aren't we able to perform? Why aren't we meeting? We have excellent five-year plans, lofty goals. Yeah, very glacial goals, but sometimes the problem, often you all know, lies in implementation, evaluation, right? So we are very good on paper, no doubt about it. We have excellent policies, procedures, sometimes just too much for even probably the bureaucrat to understand. So that's there, you know, the Administrative Reform Commission 1, when they put in 1960s, the Lokpal Bill was recommended then in ARC 1. Till date, we are struggling with that issue. 1960s. So I think that inertia that sets in, that's the problem that's holding us back. So our own read, after editing these chapters, after reading the general situation, India is of course better than Pakistan, Bangladesh, but we can't keep comparing ourselves to those countries. Better in that context, but I think our read on it is, we are happy with mediocrity. Chalta hai, chal raha hai. It's okay, it's getting done. If not today, tomorrow, day after. And that's not a problem of just governments. I'm on a project here studying reverse brain drain. I visited several Indian institutes of technology, IITs, you know, considered to be the topmost institutions in India. Well, I'd like to break this myth to you. I was very, very disappointed in the sense they are working absolutely just like a government institution. And they recognize that fact. They absolutely recognize it. But again, what do we need to do about it? DST, Department of Science Technology, all these institutions have this administrative inertia that sets in. We need to relook into those issues. So performance is certainly very, very important, bureaucratic performance. We are not holding them as much accountable. I don't want to paint a very sorry picture here. I also want to say on the other side, things are moving. There are a lot of successful projects. Professor Rumki Basu has given us excellent examples because of RTI, Right to Information Act, the best law that applies to all the different legislative branches, the federal government, all the central government, across the board, only law in the world. It's a beautiful law. But again, there are challenges there as well. But if you as a citizen filed in a request for RTI, within 30 days, if they don't respond, they are fined. And bureaucrats have told me they have been fined. I think we need more of those mechanisms. We need accountability. We need to hold people in power who are responsible for us accountable. Otherwise, everyone can start a party on their own, right? What's the point? Why are they for? So bureaucratic performance is the key if you want to counter these inefficiencies. Other issues that I think important also, decentralization, right? Devolution. India in that sense has been very good in terms of a federal form of government, thanks to the British system. They said federalism in India, and that's been working great, but there are challenges there as well. All these states that are fighting for statehood, yeah, I was there in Telangana right now, constant buns. Right? I mean, the whole premise is, I want my own state because I want to develop my own region, improvement of local government. But often it becomes a very political struggle, you know, tribal, ethnic conflicts. You know, those are setting in. I think we need to see past it. And that's another theme that jumped out. We have a whole chapter on intergovernmental relationships by Professor Rekha Saxena. She's at the Delhi University. Excellent chapter with great examples. But some work needs to be done there as well. The other concept, of course, which I can probably give a whole lecture on for months, will be corruption. Yeah. So very, very briefly, correct? Ranking of corruption in India. If you've seen Transparency India, you all know of, Transparency International, TI. Yes, so India ranks number 94 in 176 countries in terms of corruption. The best countries, less corruption, Denmark, Finland. Do you know one of the Asian countries that features in the top five Singapore. Among the best? Singapore, absolutely. I mean, Singapore is just amazing. Of course, you can argue it's a very small country. Probably Jamia Millia, further up you go, you cover Singapore. It's just this small in terms. So, but I think the whole idea about one party system sometimes can be very useful. China, for instance. Yeah. Yes, not a democracy, we can argue all about it, but for some reason the one party system works, because if the top guy says get it done, it is done. I want the stadium built by next week, you see a stadium built there by next week. So it has something to be said about one party system. I'm not against democracy, please don't get me wrong, but I think a multi-party system, these coalitions hurt us more than help us. I think that's another challenge which of course I leave it for political scientists to debate about. But corruption, as you all know, big issue, but I'm happy to see something being done about it right now. You know, the whole Lokpal movement, Anna Hazare, people's movement, grassroots movements, but again, I don't know how feasible these grassroots movements, for how long can they be? How many of you can go and rally every day? No, you have a life going on. Right? You have to study, you have to go through things. You know, 1947 was a different time when we all got together and we fought, everybody had won. But right now, lives are changed. We are in a very different world, very different society. You know, the uprisings that we've seen in Egypt, Libya, wonderful. The technology has helped. I'm sure technology is what's been helping us too here. You know, human rights you teach. You know, those are big issues that we have to think about. But corruption, it's become almost a way of life. There are three levels, right? You all know this. At the top, at the middle, at the ground level. Topmost level, we all know about all the scams that have been erupting. I have a list of scams in the book. The ethics chapter talks about, if you summed up things, I don't even know, it goes into several billion dollars. That's there. That's the top level. Then mid-level, bureaucracy level. We, you know, in terms of if you don't go in hand and glove with your senior, you are transferred. Well-known facts, right? So these federal contracts, my uncle, who's now into road contracting, he used to own an industry of some sort of, you know, small-scale industrial machines. And I met him just last month, and he said he's a road contractor now. I'm like, from machines, AC machines, to road contracting, how is that going on? He's like, well, there's money in it. I said, so you purposely make roads that every year you... He said, yes, of course we purposely make roads, so I make money every year. Because there's a set, it's very institutionalized. So, of course, there's a certain amount of money that the government allocates for the bidding process. You bid the lowest. If you bid the lowest, you don't meet your costs, correct? And then if you don't meet your costs, how do you get the money? You make the road every year. And of course, government, to even give you your payment, they have a set number, a percentage that has to be given. So it's a very clear-cut institutionalized process. It's not corruption. It's just the way how things are done. Yeah?
Service tax.
Yeah, I'm doing you service, right? This is part of it. But that's the understanding we all have gotten into, that it's okay. You know, and that's what I was talking about, the mediocrity. Things are working, things are functioning, but are we where we should be? Are we where we can be? I think that's a question we all need to ask. But there are several good things that are happening. I think media, but sometimes I've been looking at media news here, I've been quite appalled. I don't know how objective they are, but they also have been holding, they have been acting as a watchdog. There are several public-private partnerships that have been working great. Social entrepreneurship. The government has passed a law now, right? 3%, 4% of your corporate needs to go into social entrepreneurship. Is that 3 to 4% is what I hear. Yes, is what you...
35 says this.
Yes.
If you have a 100-plus crore company, then you have to give such amount.
Certain amount. So that's wonderful. Now, of course, how many people are going to attack that pie? That's yet to be seen. Right? I mean, so what I'm saying is we have these excellent laws, excellent policies to help. I mean, we've been grappling with poverty forever now. We are one country that invested more money in poverty than any other country. $34 billion in 2011 was only put in measures of poverty to alleviate poverty. Have we been able to? $34 billion. That's way more than China puts in. So we have these excellent things, and I don't deny that, but I think we need to see beyond that. I've touched upon administrative reforms a little bit, and I'll five more minutes and I'm going to. So I'm not going to belabor about administrative reforms. We are in ARC 2 now, ARC 3 hopefully. I don't know. We have lofty. I've looked through those administrative reforms, and I've looked through pages of those, and I'm not sure how much of that is even implemented, evaluated, and then rethought and refocused over. Civil service, I think they are trying to make some changes to the civil service exam itself, and I think that's much needed. In the US, we only have civil service. We've done away with civil service now, only for, say, FBI kind of jobs or postal services. That's why I think public administration programs are so useful in India, in the US, because people like you, after their graduation, can go straight work for a government without any civil service. You know, it's all test, you know, it's psychological testing. There's a lot of on-the-job testing and interviews and things like that. But we don't have a civil service. So one thing that after doing this project, it, you know, this is a question in my mind. Civil service, such a tough exam to crack, right? I'm sure many of you are aspiring to appear for civil service here. Very tough. You have to be the best and the brightest. The cream of the crop goes into civil service. Something happens in that black box inside that, you know, the top, the brightest, the smartest, and then there's something that happens. And all of that, we know what happens, but maybe we don't know quite what happens. But that's been another challenge, I think, with our civil service system. And not just here. I have a student, my PhD student is from Lebanon. And she used to be a civil servant. She was a chief financial officer in Lebanon. And she told me it's exactly the same thing there too. So we have countries, but I think we need to really see why this is happening. Now the question is there hope? Certainly there's hope. There are several wonderful examples from IT industry. You know, Right to Information Act in 2005, one of the best acts that have been passed. Pakistan still doesn't have a Freedom of Information Act, which is why we didn't have a chapter. Bangladesh did pass one in 2009, very recent. But I think that act is going to be the key, and many scholars are looking at this from world over, and we need to really keep that going. Jan Lokpal bill, certainly. We need to change these testing procedures in civil service. It has to be valid. You test them on things that they will use on the job. That's the key. But I don't think we have that. My sister wanted to do a MA in English. She went to a CPhil in Hyderabad. She took the test here in Delhi. She said they asked about math questions. So they asked me about English stuff, you know. So we have this not just in civil service, it's widespread. Our testing systems need to be really rethought. Our whole K through 12, kindergarten through 12 systems need some revamping that has to be done. We have to get away from this test-based rote learning. Doesn't do much. So that's something that needs to be looked at. But there are other things, e-seva, Gyan Doot, you know, excellent examples. Polio was eradicated in India, you know, this was massive. Up to few years ago, India was the hub for polio. I remember as a student when I was in my 12th standard, I was in NCC, National Cadet Corps, and we went door to door for polio eradication. It's been going on forever, but finally, last year we had zero cases of polio in India. How was that possible? It's the efforts of government, private sector, you know, Bollywood, just grassroots level movements. Everyone got together for this one cause. I think that's what needs to be done. We have to identify a cause, and everybody, it has to be a joint movement. You can't just expect the government to do it alone. Citizens have a role. The government has a role. Grassroots movements, the NGOs, you know, private sector, all of these have to work in sync if things need to change. So that's been a very excellent. There are other social audits, other important policy innovations that have been going on. So that's why I don't want to paint a very bad picture. I think we have the ingredients. We just have to put it together and make an excellent dish, right? So I think that's what we need to work on. I'm not going to talk about other things. So my conclusion here, this mediocrity is something I think we need to, in our everyday lives, look at. You write a paper, you just don't want to do it because, oh, it's a paper, it's an exam, let me just be done. No, look at that paper, work on that paper, reread that paper, proofread that paper. I gave a seminar in Thapar University, a workshop on resume writing. They were shocked that so much goes into a resume writing. And we just take some template, copy paste, and we are done. This copy paste mechanism is happening throughout India. Our service industry is a copy paste industry. You know, and so that's not going to work. Innovation, creativity, and again, I think that's not just one. It comes all the way from below. So we need to really look into that. I think India is certainly South Asia in that sense has been a country and or a region of paradoxes, right? We have an excellent civil service, merit-based system, yet we have all these challenges that come with it. We have bright, smart people like you in this room. You know, I've met excellent students at IIT, IISc, everywhere. We are the smartest of the lot. People like you who go abroad just outshine themselves. So we have the potential, we have the capacity, things need to be done. Healthcare, big issue now which will come in India. India only spends about 4% of its GDP on healthcare. Out of that, the private sector is spending 2.8%. So the government's really doing a very small proportion on healthcare. And as we age as a society, we need to start thinking about healthcare. Right now, that's not a big concern. So public administration in South Asia, it's shown to be, in the book at least, full of paradoxes. I think the seeds have been sown. And the seeds, what I mean by the seeds, are these administrative reforms, the grassroots movements, all the procedures, the legal reforms. Those are the seeds. They have been sown. Excellent. But I think we have to nurture them for it to grow. And the nurturing will only come by this leadership I've talked about. There is a leadership deficit, implementation. We need to really start looking at these issues. But I will let you all read the book. We talk about all of these issues, all these various aspects in the book. And the best part is you can compare it across countries in the entire region of Asia, Southeast, East, and South Asia. So this is an excellent resource, which I do want to acknowledge my co-editor, Evan Berman. Without him, I wish he was here. He was here in 2011. Both Professor Badrul Alam and Professor Basu have met him. He's in Wellington, New Zealand now. So hopefully we can get him down to India, entice him to come. He loved the food here, so maybe that's always a good way to get him. But thank you all, and I'm ready to have any questions. Thank you all. Thanks.
Thank you, Meghna, for a very thought-provoking and very wide-ranging public administration things. As she rightly said, I think there are a lot of issues on public administration that goes across this wide geographical canvas, from India to Pakistan to Sri Lanka to Bangladesh. Some of the issues are similar, some of the issues may not be similar because of the situation, the context, and the scenarios that we need. Thank you once again for your time. I think now is the Q&A time. I think this is the most interesting part, the very interactive session thing. So let us take some questions and comments. So maybe first we'll take from one right side and then go to the left.
Anyone who has any questions.
So please raise your hand and identify yourself, okay? And then we'll just go from there. Thank you.
Rick's Tourist Theory has highlighted all those issues. Then he talks about the third world countries. When you look at South Asia, it's a third world country. Now, my question is that we most of the students in public administration here have gone through Rick's. So he talks about regional unity or polynomialism or formalism and all these things. So my first question is that what's different in this group? The issues that we have raised, we have to go through the issues and then find the solution to the problems that we as a public administration face. First question. Second question is that the debate has been in public administration all this dichotomy between politics and administration. I'm seeing the challenges that Indian bureaucracy faces. How much is Indian politics responsible?
Well, I think those are excellent questions, and I'll probably tackle the first one. Riggs, rightly you mentioned, there are other Hofstede's, probably you all have read. Hofstede, very interesting observation, a kind of an epiphany I had when I was doing my project here. India has been viewed as a very collective society, correct? We all have read, we all agree with that. But I think if you go dig further down into it, why that collectivism that he and other Riggs talk about in a very broad manner doesn't quite apply, because if when it comes to getting things done, we are very individualistic. Mera ghar theek ho jaye, bahar I don't care. That attitude of that individualism is very much ingrained, which is just the opposite in Western societies, where they want the individual space when they are doing their own things, but when it comes to a common goal, a common good, they all get collectively towards that. I think that's a change, and that's why some of these broad theories we talk about might not apply in our context somewhere, certainly, but they are nuances that we certainly need to look at. When we study any of these theories, when you all study any of these theories, go back, question it. You know, does it apply to my context? Do I see this happening in day-to-day life, in my day-to-day life? When I read, you all have internet, all have smartphones, you all are well-wired. Question those things. And you know, and that's when new research comes up, new theories come. And I think that's why we need more and more work in this region, because we are different in that sense. And so what works here might not work in a different country, but it might work. Some things might work that we can apply. So we need to take the best of both worlds. I think the best thing that's going for India and going for us is we are in behind the learning curve, right, in that sense. So we can take and assess what's not worked or what might work and take the best out of it. So blindly, again, just taking and applying is not going to work. These things are going to be different. So that's your first question. The second one, remind me again, was on? Politics, administration, dichotomy.
How politics is responsible for public system. Because you mentioned in your job that we have a mail base, but what happens in the black box? Why then it becomes the, my friend says, dumbest of all? Why does that happen?
You know, we would like to think that there's this very strong dichotomy there. I challenge that dichotomy in this context. Because bureaucracies in India, like I said, have preceded these political institutions. They are feeling much more powerful in that sense, but at the same time, they are very influenced by the politics that's going around them. So it's going both ways. That it's hard to, I think, distinguish that in a Indian context. Now in the US and Western countries, we still see that dichotomy quite distinctly. Again, because there are policies, procedures, accountability, things set in place. I'm not saying that system is perfect. That has its own flaws, certainly. You know, the survey that I did in India, I thought it would be a lot harder in India, and I was doing the same survey in Texas. So I said, oh, Texas will be easy, I will do an online survey. And bureaucrats, same level there and here. To my surprise, I will tell you, India was much better because at least they would invite me to the office, chai lijiye, ye pijiye, ye khaiye. They didn't get the work done, that's a different story. But in Texas, they sent a very nasty email to my dean. Who is this doing the survey? This is scattershot research. And they had no understanding, and they didn't do it at all. So they didn't even feed me, right? And they didn't even do the work. So in that sense, I think India was much better. But what I'm saying is, I think there's again a misnomer, some myths that are involved. Bureaucracies are bureaucracies. Of course, this was Department of Transportation. They were revamping their whole system there. They were very weary of who's this outsider coming and doing research. So of course, you know, those were other issues involved. But what I want to say is, you know, there are challenges in all. We just can't take anything on its face value. And I think that's what I want to tell every one of you here. Just don't take it on its face value because I'm telling you. Please argue with me. Let's have a discourse. Let's debate these things out. But I think that's a problem that, again, I have seen in the Indian context. If I disagree with you today, you start hating me personally. You take it very personally. So let's not make it about the person. Let's make it about the position. But till we don't get over this, till it becomes this ego, things will be different. You know, I met with the directors of big institutions. If I disagreed with them, I suddenly saw a change in their body language. They will be like, when the hell is she going to get out of here? Yeah, and so I think we need that. It's okay to disagree. So we have to learn to agree to disagree. I think that's important. I think that's also lacking. This is my sense and what I've been seeing. other questions, and maybe I went way over what was needed.
Shahid,
yes.
What according to you is the future prospect of public administration as a discipline in India?
In India, it's a great question. You know, we have Professor Mishra who wrote a chapter on public administration as a discipline. Firstly, I was just having a conversation with Professor Basu. There are very few schools that offer degrees in public administration in India right now. Most of them are, of course, just like a club with political science. Not necessarily a bad thing, but in Western countries that has been separated a very long time ago, in the 60s or so. So they are very different. And I still think there are differences. Public administration study bureaucracies, right? Political science, I mean, of course, there are overlaps. You cannot separate the two. I work with criminologists. I work with sociologists, with economists, we work across, it's very interdisciplinary. But yet at the same time, I think as a discipline, we haven't evolved to where it needs to be. And I'm hoping in the future that I think that's a trend, maybe public administration schools. I was at Thapar, I was telling them, why don't you start a school of governance? And they've been looking into it because they want to diversify. OP Jindal, I was talking about, private institution, they have done something about a degree in public policy. So I think we need more of those. But till we have this very strong civil service, you know, where else are you going to go work for the government just with a degree? So small things need to be looked at is, you know, there's always a demand and supply, right? So if there's no demand in that sense, supply will be hurt too. So systems are different there, which is why every school, whether big or small, has a public administration program by itself, separate from. So I'm hoping there's more and more of that in the future. I really hope so. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Ma'am, as we have this legacy to follow the American models, we used to study in combat books that these models have been applied in America, so as India has applied these models.
Yeah.
Now, when, as per you, as America has done away with these civil services, it's only regarding the federal services in America.
Yeah.
Should India also done away with these civil services and left it to states to do what, like public services among these three services, and keep only federal services with UPSC?
Yeah, that's a tough call for me, or a tough question for me to answer, certainly. Now, what should be or should not be done? I think that's a great way to go about it, which is why I was talking about IGR, intergovernmental relationship. Central government, even though we've decentralized, is still very strong. They don't like to give up their hold, right? I mean, so there's a constant battle all the time for resources, for everything between state and center. I think we need to decentralize more, give power to states, but at the same time be very wary, because power kills. Yeah, power kills, especially in our context. We need to reanalyze, but it might not be a bad idea, which is then the demand for public administration will then, I think, increase, because you need to study about every aspect of public administration if you have schools. So, I don't know. That's a good question, but I don't know. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to ask the fact that the South Asia has recently applied a lot of qualities from the West.
Absolutely.
Need democracy, need anything.
Yeah.
They're not grown from our country. They've always been taken down by the West.
Yeah.
So isn't then we also have to look on the bureaucracy models from West side and not just try innovating ourselves, because we haven't as yet innovated the quality system.
Sure. I think we are very good at taking the best cell phones that come out, the best clothes that come out, the best accessory that comes out. You have the best perfume. Anything that is coming from the West is in our Indian malls, and we are very good at taking that. Why aren't we very good at taking the things that work there? Because that's a very difficult thing to do. It's very easy to go buy an iPhone 5 or iPhone whatever that comes out. Right? Very easy. So consumerism, we copy from the West, it's working excellently, everybody is happy, everybody makes a buck, but why aren't we taking things that work there as well? And I think that's something for the whole. It's not just one person or one institution's work. The whole psyche, attitude, change. And I think change is a difficult aspect. I ask this of my students, and I'll ask this here. How many of you sleep on the same side of the bed every day?
I sleep on the same side of the
bed.
Yeah, single bed. No choice. Some people don't have a choice, right? But generally, given you pick your side, right? You pick your side, you stick with it. If you're sitting, so this I'll ask you in your own classrooms. Professors will validate it for me. When you sit the first day, you sit on that seat until the end of the semester, you're sitting on that same seat. Not just here, everywhere, it's a universal. My students do that too. So that aspect of change is very, very difficult. In our own little ways, in our own little seats, we are so rigid about it. So change, this whole needs a very, very different approach, a different mindset, open-mindedness, and I think that's not something that can come overnight.
साउथ एशिया में एक सबसे बड़ी सच्चाई है गांव और इसमें भारत में भारत या पूरे साउथ एशिया में सबसे ज़्यादा जनसंख्या गांव में रहती है और जिस तरीके से ई गवर्नमेंट और ई गवर्नमेंटाइजेशन किया जा रहा है जिससे कि इफिशियंसी इफेक्टिवनेस आए लेकिन और गांव में ये सबसे बहुत से दूर है अभी भी तो इस मतलब इस इफिशियंसी के लिए हम एक बहुत बड़ी आबादी को दूर करते जा रहे हैं तो इस लूपर को कैसे
या आपने बिल्कुल सही कहा कि जो गैप हो रहा है बहुत इंक्रीज होते जा रहा है राइट द रिच एंड द पुअर गैप कीप्स वाइडनिंग तो ये हो ही रहा है बट आप गांव गांव में जाइए सेलफोन सबके पास है खाने को हो ना हो सेलफोन जरूर रहेगा सो दैट नीड टू बी कनेक्टेड इज देयर एंड आई थिंक वी रियली नीड टू फोकस एंड लाइक आई वाज सेइंग पॉवर्टी एलिविएशन गाँव में इंडिया ने $34 billion स्पेंड किया 2011 में ऑन पेपर वी शुड हैव बीन अ कंट्री अबव दैट We've been struggling, and I think we keep saying, oh, it's just 60 plus years since our independence, give us time. And there's something to be said about evolution, right? US in the 60s had its same problem. Water was horrible, environmental issues, bahut the 50s, 60s mein. Don't think US was born like that. People littered on the roads all over, just like here. Sub issues the, 1960s, US was a very different country than what it is today. तो उन्होंने भी देर इज एन एवोल्यूशन प्रोसेस दे हैव गॉन थ्रू ये सर्टनली वी आर अ यंग डेमोक्रेसी बट आई डोंट थिंक वी कैन कीप राइडिंग ऑन दैट ईयर इन एंड ईयर आउट कि हम यंग डेमोक्रेसी हैं वी नीड टू फोकस ऑन की इशूज ऑफ पॉवर्टी ये यू नो पॉवर्टी एलिविएशन मेजर्स पॉलिसीज फूड फॉर ऑल कीप्स कमिंग एक्सीलेंट वी हैवन बीन एबल टू फिगर आउट द अनाज का जो शॉर्टेज होते इंडिया प्रोड्यूसेस The amount of wastage, I talked to a professor, he said the amount of wastage in food that we do in India is equivalent to the production of Australia. It equals, post-harvest storage mein humne kuch bhi nahi kiya hai. Post-harvest technology and storage doesn't require too much money. Itna jo anaj produce ho raha hai, aaj jo onions 80 rupay kilo touch kar rahe hain, it's not supposed to be, we know that. हम लोगों ने आर्टिफिशियल इन्फ्लेशन क्रिएट किया हुआ है फॉर सर्टन पीपल टू ऑफकोर्स बेनिफिट आउट ऑफ देयर सो मेनी थिंग्स दैट कैन बी डन वाटर इज गोइंग टू बी द बिगेस्ट इशू इन इंडिया ऑलरेडी इज वी आर स्ट्रगलिंग विद वाटर इलेक्ट्रिसिटी जो बेसिक चीज़ें हैं ये हमको कैसे भी फिगर आउट करना है आई वॉज क्वाइट इम्प्रेस व्हेन आई वेंट टू गुजरात द स्टेट ऑफ गुजरात वॉज क्वाइट प्रोग्रेसिव इन दैट तो हमको वी हैव टू गेट द वेल्थ To percolate down, the wealth keeps coming, it's floating among the top few percentage. So, ye hum kaise niche tak layenge, that's again for the whole political system to look into. But I certainly agree, we need to focus on this. Oh, there was one more question and then we take it again.
As far as we know, this regulatory impact assessment, RIA, is a very specialized aspect of public policy analysis in the countries that belong to the OECD. Now, in this particular group, how far have you mapped this potential of RIA?
Okay.
Public, and I want to tell you one thing, there was one seminar in the month of April that I gave, where one ex-Indian bureaucrat, he worked in IAS for 21 years, now he has taken his job in Victoria Territory of Australia. And you know, Victoria Territory of Australia has set a global example in the success of the regulatory impact assessment of the public policy analysis. And he was also arguing that the failures of the NHRM or the other flagship programs that we've seen, had there been a true regulatory impact assessment in that aspect, it would not have happened. Do you agree with
it? I absolutely agree. And there's some of that in the public policy chapter. Professor Dolly Arora from Indian Institute of Public Administration.
Okay.
She has a chapter that you can go over.
And but she also attended the seminar here.
Yes, I'm
she
sure
was
she
was also there.
I'm sure she was there. You know, she's of course a faculty there at IIT, as you mentioned that. She has a chapter, she does address some of it. But I think I absolutely agree. We, like I said, we have excellent policies on paper, but we need this evaluation system. First step is implementation, right, in the public policy cycle. Implementation, then evaluation. I think we do a bad job at both. Implementation also is there, but I think then the next step is evaluation. What works, what doesn't work. And this is broadly, not just to deregulation, not just to a particular policy. I think it applies to any policy that's put in place. We need to look at that. I agree with that bureaucrat who talks about the evaluation.
And he also approached another view. I don't know how far you agree with that. He was saying that this is our domain. That is especially for economists. People who are highly experts, not even experts of public administration, anthropology and sociology. I mean other branches, he's saying that only economists can do that. Will you agree with this?
I don't think, you know, in this day and age, I agree partly but not completely. I don't think in this day and age you can separate disciplines because the societal implications, everyone's involved in. Yes, economists can do a very good job at forecasting, but I would argue they haven't done much of a good job in forecasting at all. You know, look at the 2008 debacle in the US, the economic crisis. These were economists, right? These are economists who've been predicting all of what happened. They could not make predictions. So I don't think it is for one discipline or for one area. Of course, they can run models, they can help other disciplines being involved, but I don't think it can be a single pronged approach. Several other implications and disciplines have to be. That's another area that's lacking, I think, is interdisciplinarity. We can talk about that later on. But you had a question.
Yes, ma'am. Now, when one gets into civil services and there's usually a 2-year probationary period where the inductees get trained. So, what are the differences in the methods of training in India and the objectives as compared to the West?
Like I said, civil service, they have done away with. The only areas that have some sort of testing is FBI, very specialized, Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Postal Services. The rest, say, if I were to apply for a government job, maybe in the HR department for, say, doing procurement, the tests that are given are related to the kind of job they'll be doing.
Ma'am, what about the training?
And the training itself, on-the-job training, they do...
Ma'am, so a question revolves around about the journalist versus the specialist.
Certainly.
So what do you think? Do we need to shift from journalist to specialist right now?
I would argue that we need the other way around. You know, what makes you very marketable is being a generalist approach.
Jack of all trades, master?
Yeah, you know, that's fine, but I think because the way economies are going nowadays, even in the US, even now, India's economy is now suddenly on the downfall here. We need skills that are more transferable. Having one area of speciality is great, but if that's the only thing you can do, how are you going to transfer your skills and make yourself more marketable? So I would say to all of you, it's good to have one area, but have several backup plans, not just one. You know, so that will help you in this day and age, in you know, for marketability purposes. And that's what I tell my HR students too, is it's good to specialize in, say, one area of, say, training. Training is great, you can specialize, but at the same time, if the economy tanks, no more training people required, at least if you had a certain skill set that can be transferable, you can get a job. So don't just focus too much.
We can take just one final question.
Yeah,
please.
You talked about citizen-centric administration,
yes,
by including RTA.
Yes.
So what do you think is the role of the people participation? Because I think that there is also a problem from the citizens' point of view. They are not participating in the policies as such.
Yeah.
So have you covered this thing?
Their attitude remains that, well, if my house is clean and I don't care about my neighbors, I'm going to throw trash there, I don't think anything will happen.
So when the entire blame on bureaucratic administration is not right,
it's a multi-pronged. It's not just the bureaucracy or the political institutions or any other private institution. I think it's our responsibility as well. As citizens, we have voted them in, right? We have to hold them accountable.
Yes.
There are various accountability measures that are there, you all read of, you are aware of. But how many of you make aware of those? How many of you have filed the RTI here? Couple of you.
more and more needs to be done. So I just think it is definitely our responsibility. We cannot abdicate our responsibility and say, look, I voted you in, now you take care. We've done that. And that's why this grassroots movement, RTI itself is a grassroots movement, started in Rajasthan. Excellent. I think we need more of those. But then it has to be both ways too. We can't do enough, just as we are seeing in Egypt, right? The whole country is shut down. Now citizens can't be protesting on the road 365 days a year. What will do to our economy? Economy, tourism in Egypt has just tanked. The whole economy is hurt. We can't afford to do that. But yet at the same time, there have to be mechanisms in place. How many of you go to public debates? Are there public debates here, firstly? No. We need to have that. That is where accountability, citizen participation comes in. Even in the US, when you have these public debates, it's mostly the senior citizens who are there. So I ask my students to hardly a couple of them go. It's all open to the public. So I think we need that whole mechanism, a real shift. And I'm really hopeful. I'm hopeful for our country. And I want our country, the 2020 vision for the country, which has just come out in science technology, was we will be in the top 5 global scientific powers by 2020. I think it's a tall order. Might not be 2020. 2020 is 7 years apart. I think it might be maybe 2030. But we need to get there. We need to challenge, and challenge these structures around us. So I'm hopeful. I don't want to be very pessimistic. I'm hopeful.
I think I would like to compliment Dr. Meghna Sabharwal for a very persuasive, very perceptive presentation. I think we all learned a great deal from it. I think in our respective classes, we'll take some of these ideas forward. Let me also remind you that next month, on 5th and 6th of November, we are going to have a national seminar on public policy delivery. So this will be catered to students of public administration, political science, human rights. So all of you are most welcome. We'll keep you informed and apprised of all the things. Dr. Meghna, again, she is also going to be present in both days of the national seminar. She herself is also going to present a paper of her own. May I now request my colleague, Professor Rumki Basu, to offer a formal vote of thanks.
Thank you, Meghna, and I must thank all our students here who've been waiting since the morning to hear you.
Thank you.
I think
I didn't disappoint.
No, you didn't. You didn't disappoint me at all. And I'm sure I speak on behalf of my students when I stand here and propose the vote of thanks. Meghna, I think my meeting with Meghna, having first met her, I think 2 years back in 2011, it's been a turning point of my life. I have to confess this. I have rarely met an Indian scholar, or perhaps because it's my lack of exposure that I I'm not a very globally traveled person as Dr. Alam happens to be. I do not meet many Indian scholars who are working abroad. So Meghna was one I met in 2011, and the way she impressed me on the need to write this book, I contributed a chapter. That was an amazing story. I must truly tell you that she's a very young person. And
no, I'm not that young.
Yes, you are a very young person. And her devotion, her dedication, her professionalism, and her work ethics, and her academic, and she's learned the best. If she has inculcated the best from best of the US work ethics, she was saying, why don't we take their best? Why do we always need to emulate what is not the best in the West? Well, she is one of the few scholars I've met who've taken the best of US, or let's say Western academic ethics. She's very hardworking, very energetic, and I think you work 24/7. That's her attitude, that if you're a scholar, you need to be working, studying, writing, attending seminars, and planning your next project, which she always is in the process of doing. So it was her persuasion, that convinced Dr. Alam. She had already convinced Dr. Alam before, but she had to convince me to contribute a chapter to this book. Frankly, when we got started, I was extremely... I was a little skeptical.
Sure, we all were.
We all were that, you know, whether we would, this book would turn out to be the product that it is here in front of you today. She did run into a lot of problems. She was very modest about it. She wouldn't speak about them. But we do know how hard she struggled in these 2 years to get this book ready. We've all done our chapters, and to write that chapter on Right to Information in India, I think after years, I went to government officers, to bureaucrats, to students, and to other civil society activists. You know, the kind of thing I had not done for a very long time. You know, to be actually on the field and to be interviewing people, talking to bureaucrats. And Sailesh Gandhi gave me a very big interview in his office. And I had to do the kind of research, the primary research, which I hadn't done for years. So thanks to Meghna, this work brought me back to research. Now, as you all know, I'm on a year sabbatical. And this time, it's a book on Indian administration that I have been planning for a while. And I hope to complete the project. I don't think I'll be completing it by 15 November. I get back to the department on 15 November. I'll take a couple of months more. But this project, this 1 year sabbatical, really helped me to get back to Indian administration. I teach, as you all know, my students know that I only teach papers on administrative theory or administrative thinkers. After this 1 year sabbatical, I've got back to Indian administration. And the kind of research that I'm doing, I hope I'll be able to write a couple of things where I will challenge Meghna and some of the points she's raised and some of the issues that she's raised here today. I personally think India is the most difficult country in this world to administer. So therefore, we need to understand the successes and work and try to understand the work of the Indian public administration, whether it's an officer at the central level or state level or the local level. The enormity of the challenges that they face is something I intuitively feel that perhaps no other public administrator in the world has to face. So given the backdrop in which our administrators work, the achievements that I looked into in these last 50 years, I'm very, very confident about the next 20 or next 30 years. And you know, the acts that Meghna was talking about, I'd like to add one more. The Right to Public Services Guarantee Acts that have been spearheaded by the states. She was talking of the RTI, and I've written extensively on the RTI, but I think it is these acts rather than the Lokpal Bill. It's a hyped kind of discussion on corruption. Whenever there's a discussion on corruption, invariably it's the issue of the Lokpal and the Lokpal Bill and how it's being sabotaged. And therefore, you know, corruption can never really be attacked or addressed. I think it's far more important to have acts like the RTI or the Right to Public Services Guarantee Acts. More than 12 states have passed these acts, where you actually hold designated officers responsible to perform, to execute or implement certain services or acts. And they are penalized if they don't. So accountability of a very different kind is being talked about rather than the overarching Lokpal Bill. We already have the Lokayuktas for performing in so many states. So I think it's not only RTI, it's the fact that the government has changed hugely today. We talk of governance and not government, and there are multi actors on the governance scene. That kind of competition, I think Indian bureaucracy needed if it had to be performing or had to develop or improve. It's not just the administrative reforms, where you still act, where you're still working in a monopolistic ambience. Mm-hmm. So what the LPG era has really done is to bring in the kind of competition to bureaucracy through multiple actors who work for the community, and it's problem solving at the community level, at the state level, at the local level, at the central level, that we need to look at when we talk of Indian public administration and the challenges to Indian public administration today. The best thing that has happened are the new economic policies where the government stopped to be a monopolistic service provider. You need competition everywhere to be able to improve your standards. Plus these accountability, built-in accountability service acts, the RTI, and so many other draft bill, the civil services, code of conduct bill that's coming. So I think in this last 1 year, I've been looking at a number of things, a number of issues, number of developments, where I look at Indian democracy, issues of development and issues of governance. They're all intertwined, democracy, development and good governance issues, which have really opened my eyes to a lot. I do look at the challenges that our administrators face more than maybe the negative issues that are the stereotypical or the kind of book, you know, somebody questioned here, what is new in this book? What is it that you're saying that is new about Indian public administration? We've been reading about Indian public administration for years. I think, I hope, I haven't read the other chapters, that it's not just a pan-Indian movement to reform public administration. It's a pan-South Asian movement, perhaps, now, which has been addressed in this book. So if you do get a chance, there will be more copies for our department. We'll buy them, keep them in the library. So do look at all these changes, reforms, which have not necessarily come from the government. So the momentum for reforms in public administration has come from the citizen, civil society activists, the judiciary, the private sector, and of course, the government. So therefore, I personally feel, and of course she ended on an optimistic note, I would end on an optimistic note as well, that just watch out what's happening in India in the next 20, 25 years. And you would get a much better performing bureaucracy in the next 20, 25 years. In the India Vision 2020, we need to be more optimistic. And I'm sure a lot is happening which should be looked at very carefully. So with these words, I thank Meghna once again for the brilliant lecture. She raised the issues that need to be raised. She's looked at things that need to be looked at, which we often overlook. And she has the right perspective, the South Asian perspective, or perhaps the global perspective, which we need to also understand when we are looking at Indian public administration. So thank you, Meghna. Thank you all for being with us. Thank you.